I have to announce something that no chief of police ever wants to announce, but one of our Overland Park officers was killed late this afternoon.
He was a good officer. He did his job. I mean, that's what he was doing. He was going into work. He observed a hit-and-run accident, and he was trying to call out to officers to get to the scene.
I just knew. I knew in my heart that he had passed away, and that's when they come out, when my wife and his wife got there.
And I looked at the one, I said, is it Philip? And he said, yes.
You know, Philip made his choices there, and Mike made his choices, but what always comes back to me, and what Shelley would tell me and we would discuss, is that they lost a son too. And that son was a valued member of their family and was loved. And, you know, when children make a decision that causes you pain, it doesn't mean that you don't love them anymore.
Julie came out the door and said, you're not going to believe this. The Mosiers want us to come to their son's funeral. And I felt like I was levitating off the driveway.
Growing up, I had no forgiveness. But then, after I met my wife, Shelley, I started learning about forgiveness. And I don't know why it was instant forgiveness the night that this happened. I had no malice in my heart.
Today's going to be a very powerful episode, and primarily because of the guests we have on and the heart that he's going to share, his passion, what he's been through, and I think it's going to affect you in a very positive way. So I'm very excited to welcome Scott Mosier to the show. Scott, thank you for being with us on Time for Forgiveness.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. So, Scott, I just want to jump right into this. Your family was obviously affected in a very profound way just a couple of years ago with your son, Mike. And I think for our audience and their benefit, for those who don't know the story about what happened with Mike, if you wouldn't mind just jumping right in to the top and telling everybody what transpired that day.
Okay, my son, Mike Mosier, was a policeman in Overland Park, Kansas. He'd been on almost 15 years, and one Sunday, he was on his way to work, and he saw a traffic accident, a hit and run, and he followed the suspect. And he was, like I said, he was on his way to work. He was in uniform in his personal car. He had his radio, but didn't have a body cam, and so he called it in and said he was following the person of the hit and run, who happened to turn towards the police department where he was on his way to. As he called it in and asked for backup, the guy in the hit and run stopped his car in the middle of the street and got out and started walking out in the middle of the street. Mike pulled over and stopped and addressed him. And Mike had actually, which we found out later, had taken his cell phone and put it on record and stuck it in his shirt pocket. So this whole incident was recorded, unbeknownst to anybody, because his body cam was at the station. So he had a talk with the individual in the middle of the street, tried to talk the young man out to go the side of the road, told him there was help on the way. The guy said some few choice words to him and told him he didn't like the police, and pulled a gun on him and shot him. And at that moment, as Mike was struggling, as you know, for the guy's gun, the guy fired two rounds. One round hit his vest, and the other went under his vest and hit his carotid artery. And in that time, as Mike was struggling, Mike pulled his gun and shot the suspect five times. So they both died there that day in the street.
Well, first of all, I'm so sorry for your loss. So this all transpired in the afternoon?
Right, in the afternoon. It was about 10 to 6.
Okay, and then, so take us to the next, what's the next thing that happened? You received not a phone call, but Mike's daughter.
Right.
Came over to
your house. My wife and I had sold our house in Olathe and moved to an apartment complex. We were looking to downsize and moved to an apartment complex next door to Mike, so we could watch my granddaughter, because his wife traveled all the time, and he worked, obviously, graveyard at the time. And so she'd come over and spend the night with us. She was 12 years old. And so we moved next door to him. And on that day, we were having dinner, and my granddaughter was at her house with her mother. And, you know, it was Mother's Day was coming up, and Mike had told his wife and my granddaughter that he was leaving early for work to mail some Mother's Day cards, which Mike had never done in his life. So as I was outside with our dog and walking the dog, and Mike came out, and I said, "Hey, how come are you leaving early?" I said, "You never leave early a day in your life for work." And he said, "Well, I'm going to mail these Mother's Day cards." And I said, "Well, you writing a Mother's Day card?" And he said, "Yeah, I felt that I needed to do that." And he said, "I've had the best day ever with the family. We got up early. We've had breakfast. We've played games today. We had a late lunch, and it's just the best day I've had in a very, very long time with the family." And so he had told me that he had even brought an extra uniform, because the night before I had to take him a uniform because he had gotten an altercation with a lady who had COVID. And so they basically, when that happens, they take him into a sanitation booth, and they would sanitize them, and they had to have an extra uniform, which he didn't have, so I brought to him. And he said, "Dad, I even have the extra uniform." I told him I loved him, be safe, he'd give the dog a hug, and off he went. About 20 minutes later, my granddaughter comes running over and says, "Grandpa, Grandma, my dad's been shot." And I said, "What?" I mean, it was total disbelief. How could he have been shot? He's not even at work
yet. You just saw him 20 minutes ago, 30 minutes ago?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I said, he's not even at work. And she said, "Three police officers came to the door to tell us he had been shot and we needed to get to the hospital." Well, being an ex-police officer myself, they never send three police officers to anyone's house unless it's a death notification. And I don't know why they didn't at that time tell us that he had passed away. But my granddaughter and I went to the hospital. His wife, Corinne, came over, and her and Shelly, they were getting things together, and then they were on their way to the hospital as well. Tyler and I got there, and there was a lot of police officers there, the chief of police, the person that actually found him, the officer that found him in the street was there. He was not in uniform, which surprised me because he was working that day, and I knew he was working. I have a pretty close relationship with the police department through Mike at that time. And I just knew. I knew in my heart that he had passed away, and that's when they come out, when my wife and his wife got there, came out and told us he had passed away in the emergency room. But in all honesty, he had passed away in the street with the man that shot him. So total disbelief. You know, you just don't want to believe it. And, of course, you know, the sadness that comes with it and, you know, the people there trying to console you and everything. But, I mean, I had a different feeling personally. I had one of just regret, but I was also, when the circumstances were relayed, I felt that Mike had done exactly what he was put to do on this earth. He had, you know, 2 years earlier been in a gunfight with a guy and survived that gunfight. And, you know, unfortunately, the person that was shooting at him, he had killed, along with his partner. And, you know, of course, he received Medal of Valor for that and Officer of the Year for Valor because he could have run away. But, you know, that's not what police do. And in this instance, I guess I was still in shock when we saw him. I had a solid belief that he had done what he was supposed to do. And, you know, and I thought, you know, this could be somebody else. You go through that. Why not somebody else? But I didn't have that feeling. I just felt that it was his job to do. And my wife had that feeling, too.
Well, that's pretty powerful. I mean, what caught my attention about your story, obviously, Scott, was your reaction to all this and how you handled it. Because I think, you know, there's problems and then there's crises that everybody goes through, you know, crises in their life. And this was a crisis. But your response to it was very unique in the sense that how you responded to the Carney family, which was the perpetrator's family. And so can you tell our audience then, you know, how this all transpired in terms of you reaching out to them or they reached out to you? Because I want you to share then what happened at the funeral. And I'm just going to preface it by saying that I don't know for sure, but I don't believe I would have had that same response, especially only days after your son was killed. So that was, to me, that's just an act of courage and an act of faith to be able to choose that response, because it was a choice. And we can choose either way. I think for the majority of people, probably it wouldn't have been that way. Yours was different, and that's what makes it so unique, and that's why I'm so inspired to hear your story and share your story. Can you tell us then what happens after that point?
Well, after we had left the hospital, and when we got home, people were already there to, you know, help us get through and handle our grief and mm-hmm. be there for us. The police department provided a 24-hour officer surveillance team to be at our house to help us if we needed anything for until Mike was buried, which was almost about a week and a half later, I think 2 weeks, mm-hmm. When we had the overall funeral. But the night of, there was food arriving and people were coming and, you know, to offer condolences. And we got a order from a barbecue place, a huge barbecue order. And my wife said, well, who sent this? Because she wanted to know, because she wanted to thank people that were sending food and things right. like that. And they said, well, they wanted to be anonymous. Of course, if you knew my wife, you know, who actually passed away 9 months after my son, she goes, that's unacceptable. So finally got out of the kid that brought it, who happened to be a son-in-law of the Carneys. Mm-hmm. Told us who had brought it, and it was the Carney family. Well, you know, what do you think about that? You know, the person that killed your son, their family is sending you food. My wife looked at me and said, this can't be anonymous. We have got to call them. And I said, absolutely we do. And so my wife called them. And in short order, as my wife turned to me, she said, you know, they lost a son too. And I said, it's just how you feel right now is how they feel. And while the circumstances may be different, one was protecting and the other was the person that was causing the harm, you still love your son. And we have got to reach out to them, and that's what we did. And we reached out to them, and they're a great family. My son knew his uncle, worked with his uncle. He was an Overland Park retired police officer. His father was a retired police or firefighter and arson investigator for the city as well. And, you know, Philip had a good upbringing. Mm-hmm. But they lost that son, too. And so we reached out to them, and we actually invited them to Mike's funeral, and they sat beside my wife and I. And here we were with, you know, 1,000 people at a funeral, you know, 400 of them police officers or more, probably more like 600 policemen all along the way, but and guests that were invited. But remember, it was during COVID, so,
right.
you know, but they chose to have this funeral anyway. But they sat beside us, and there was a lot of people that wondered why we did that. And it was because they lost a son as well, and we had nothing but love and forgiveness for the Carneys. They didn't do anything. Their son made that choice, and it has no reflection on the family. It was a choice he made, and he was, you know, he was under the influence of alcohol and drugs. Mm-hmm. He had been arrested several times previously. He was out of control, and that's not the parents' fault. He even had threatened his parents, and Mike had actually helped him, was working with him to get a restraining order against their own son at the time. It just worked out that way. Oh, wow. Mike didn't know him, had never seen him. Mm-hmm. He just got out of jail for assaulting a police officer with a knife in Lawrence, Kansas. Judge let him out on bail, and which was the second time he had assaulted police officers as he was arrested. And, you know, probably should have never been out, but the court system is what it is. And it just, it wasn't on them. It's Philip Carney made his choices, and Mike made his, you know, to stand and to protect and to serve. And we felt bad for them, too. And then later on, as my wife was talking, the Carneys invited us to Philip's funeral, and we went. We went to support them, and we went to show that we had forgiven him for what he had done. There was no malice. There was, it was just something that happened. And I think the Lord's hand has to do with any time when somebody passes away, the Lord brings you home. And
okay, so that leads to my question, because I hear your story and I'm moved by your story, and I can understand as you're saying it now, but that goes beyond most people's understanding. Like, to be able to feel that way or make that type of decision, I feel, or I guess my question is, at the time, did you feel divinely inspired? Did you feel led? Was there something beyond your understanding that is leading you to make that kind of decision? Because that wasn't 6 months, a year, 5 years from now. That was instantaneously that you were open to that. And I guess I would like you to maybe go a little further with that.
Well, there's another story that goes with that. As far as for me, when I was 8 years old, my mom was killed. She was hit by a train and killed in a car accident. And I was dropped off at a babysitter. It was her first day of a new job. She was following somebody. That lady she was following went across the railroad tracks. My mom didn't look both ways. A train was coming. Back then, they didn't have, you know, the rails that come down, and she pulled out in front of a train and was killed. When that happened, I knew she had died. I saw the smoke in the distance, and one of the workers there come up to me and said, "Why are you crying? You're 8 years old. You shouldn't be crying that your mom dropped you off at a daycare center." I said, "I'm crying because my mom just died."
You just had this intuitive knowing.
I just knew.
You just knew.
I didn't know why I knew that until I was preparing a talk in church a couple weeks ago. I think the Lord prepares you for what you're going to go through in life. And everything that you do and everything you face prepares you for something else. The Lord never gives you more than you can handle. Well, I was a bitter child. I didn't have the Lord in my life. I went to church off and on, but I had no preparation for my mom's death. I mean, at 8 years old, how could you?
Right.
And up until I was probably about 18, 19, I was just a bitter person. you know, why would the Lord do this to me? How could he take my mother? I had no background. And later on, when I met my wife, Shelley, she gave me a different perspective. And I never really thought about it until later. You know, I lost my dad young. All my grandparents were young. You know, it seemed like I was always being chased by death, if you would. And I had a different perspective back then. But then, as I found the Lord in my life and understood, I look back and I think he prepared me for Mike's death and Shelley's death. You expect your parents to pass away. I mean, you get death because you lived. I mean, that's just a natural thing that's going to happen. And you somewhat expect that. But you don't expect to lose a child. That's not how it's supposed to be. You can even expect to lose a spouse due to illness and things like that. But, you know, you'd never expect to lose a child. That's not how it works. And as I look back over the last couple of weeks, I really do think that I reacted the way I did because I fully understand that I'll be together with my son again. And I didn't blame anybody. I didn't blame Philip. I didn't blame my son or anybody. His purpose on life was fulfilled, and he was brought home. And that's the Lord's plan, that, you know, we'll be brought home in the Lord's time, not our time. And did I grieve? Sure. Did I feel sorry for myself? I did. But then when I was a kid, I looked back on why not somebody else? But I looked at Mike as he did what the Lord wanted him to do. He took some evil out of the world that had evil plans, and in doing so, he lost his life.
Yeah. Mike was a hero. I mean, he really was. You know, he gave everything.
He gave it all. Yeah. And, you know, he had been the incident 2 years earlier under fire, mm-hmm. reacting. He survived that one. The perpetrator died. Mm-hmm. I think at the time I look back, I was more worried about how that would change Mike's personality and taking a life, because we've all been taught that life is sacred and we don't take them. Mm-hmm. It's not part of our DNA. But with Mike, I was worried about, would it change him? And it didn't, because he knew what his purpose was. He made it right with the Lord, understanding that he was protecting and serving and doing what the Lord would do. And I think that's everything pointed to that day, that was his purpose. And I was proud of that purpose.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I appreciate you going deeper with that and sharing. But you said something very profound in that, in regards to, you know, this journey that all of us have eventually with loss and grief, is that you changed your reaction to it. And was that when you felt that you were able to maybe move forward and your perspective changed about being able to offer the forgiveness?
You know, it was not hard for me to offer the forgiveness, because when I was young, I had no forgiveness, and it was against the Lord. It wasn't against the person that drove the train. It wasn't against my mother. It was on the Lord. And when I came to terms with that, I just felt forgiveness from the very first. A lady in our church had written a card, and it really hit us, because we opened it a couple days after Mike died. It said, you know, I picture Mike being the person that he was, reaching down as he was going to heaven, reaching down and extending his hand and saying to Philip, here, let me help you, let me show you the way. And that was Mike to a T. How could I, after reading that, knowing that Mike is that type of individual. And that was how he was raised. How could I be bitter? I couldn't talk about Mike's death unless I had total forgiveness. And with my mom, I had to forgive myself for the beliefs that I had. I didn't know about self-forgiveness because all forgiveness starts when we forgive ourselves first, and that's the hardest thing to ever do. We mess up and we find it hard to forgive ourselves for what we did.
That's very true, very true.
How can I forgive others if I can't forgive myself?
Right. We can't give what we don't feel inside.
Right.
Yeah, very powerful.
I love the word hope because it's the idea that, like, tomorrow can be better. And I think we sometimes forget that hope is that we do have these beliefs that whether we've chosen them or they've been conditioned in us, and we have the ability to unlearn, to relearn, to recondition, to accept new ideas. And that is hope. And I'm sitting here, you know, what an inspiration to all our audience that if you were able to do that based on what you just shared, you know, what can all of our listeners plus all of us decide, you know, that we're willing to do or maybe to accept? Because I hear it, but it is beyond my understanding. I guess I hope I would be able to do that myself. I want to go back to something you said earlier. You had said that you did have regret. And I was wondering, maybe go a little deeper with that.
Well, you know, I regret the way I acted growing up. I regret the fact that Mike was killed. There is a little regret there. I wouldn't have wished it on anyone else. That's what I would do. I would do the same thing Mike did. And I have regrets that my granddaughter's growing up without a father, but I don't hold Philip Carney in the regards that he was the one that did it. Mike could have been killed. When the Lord takes you, he takes you. And however he does, he's going to. And Mike went out, doing what he was asked to do. And while I may regret it on the natural man side of me, I'm proud that Mike stepped up and did what he did. Right. I'm proud that he took some buddy who was out of control, that was intent on probably doing bad things because of his condition and who he had turned into. I don't have any regrets of that. I feel that Mike was doing what he was asked to do. Right. He started off, he was going to be a fireman. Why did he pick to turn that into being a policeman? When he left on a mission for our church for 2 years, he was working with Johnson County Fire Department, mm-hmm. and he was going to be a fireman. But yet when he come back, he wanted to go to the police academy. Why did that happen? You know, I can't tell you why. And when I asked Mike that, you know, he said, well, you remember the times you used to give me a ride in your patrol car? I said, yeah. He said, well, I finally came over from the dark side and decided to go to, you know, the right
he's
side.
On the A-team, okay.
But, you know, why did he choose that?
Right.
You know, I think that when you're given choices, the choices you make lead you down your path of life. And sometimes when we use free agency, we tend to go against who we are and what we do, and we do the wrong things, and sometimes we do the right things. But I have no regrets of him being a policeman. I don't have any regrets of the shooting. I don't have any regrets there because I think Mike did what he was supposed to do.
Well, I know that for me, that's a very inspiring message, that because living with regret, it's just a weight that'll pull you down, and it's destructive. And You know, I think too, though, Scott, like you always hear this, you know, you won't be remembered for the things, you know, that you accumulate. It's always, you know, what did you be? Who did you become and what's your legacy? How will people remember you? And I'm sure you're very proud of how people remember your son.
Because yeah. That's all we have. That's all we have. When someone's gone, we just have memories. And that's how they stay alive within your heart. And at least for me, you know, Mike is alive to me because of who he was and what I remember of him. And there's not a week that goes by that somebody doesn't come up and say, you know, I'm sorry about Mike, and this is what I remembered about him. Right. Happened to me at church on Sunday. A young lady that Mike used to hang out with, and I haven't seen her in probably 20 years, she came up to me after church and said, you know, I miss Mike because he helped me this and he helped me that. And he was the one there when you know, I was going to school and needed somebody at school to kind of watch over me. And it was just, I hear that all the time. Who he was more than just the policeman that was in a shootout that lost his life. People that he arrested have reached out to the family afterwards and said, you know, he got me on the straight and narrow because even though he arrested me, he got me help.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And this was the kind of thing. I had one of the police psychiatrists that, you know, they have a COPS program. Basically, they call it the CAT program that, you know, they go out when people are in distress. They call, they have a police officer and they have somebody, another first responder that's trained in how to deal with people that are having mental issues and things. And she said, I went on a call the other day, and this was probably about 6 months or 8 months ago. She said, I went on a call and there was a young lady that we were helping, and she had said, well, how's Mike doing, Mike Mosier? And she said, well, Mike Mosier was killed in the line of duty, you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. And she started crying. Yeah. And she said that one day Mike had, on patrol, found her and her kids in their car, and they were living in their car and had no place to go, didn't have any money, and Mike was able to get her help and take her and paid for a hotel room and all that till the help could get there. And, you know, and she had help, you know, family help coming from another state, and but she had no place to stay. And Mike actually paid for a hotel room for this young lady and for her kids for a couple of days. I didn't even know that.
That was just the type of person he was.
That's just who he was. And I don't know if the department knew it or not, but you know, this is the tale that the girl has said. And when I hear those stories like that, it gives me a memory to know that and verify that that is who my son was. And how can I be bitter about his death when he's so remembered so fondly and so well by everybody else? I just can't see how I could be bitter.
Well, I really appreciate, Kelly and I really appreciate you sharing your story, and it's so inspiring, and it really moved me the first time I met you, Scott, and I heard your story, and it just really caused me to think, and I think I definitely came to the conclusion I needed to reevaluate how I would have responded in your situation. It's changed me as a person. So we're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back with Paul and Julie Carney, and Paul and Julie are going to join Scott here together. All right, everyone, welcome back. We're here again with Scott Mosier, and we're welcoming in Paul and Julie Carney. And Paul and Julie, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, I want to just start and kind of kick this off. And, you know, I found an article that was written back in August of 2020, and it was I think, an interview you did with Fox 4 News. And, Julie, you had said, quote, you did not recognize the person caught on camera that day, referring to your son, Philip. and then you were reflecting back on who he was, I think, you know, in his younger years, and you said that he was a very artistic and talented young child, and he wanted to be a baseball player when he grew up. What do you think, can you kind of reflect back, and I know you had also mentioned in that article that you tried to get him help when he was around age 11, I think is what it said.
Yes, that's correct.
And so what, at that age, at 11, what was going on at that time that, you know, you felt like you needed to get him help?
Well, he would go in his room and he would lay on his bed and just be staring at the ceiling when the other kids were playing, and we have five children, he's the second. And, you know, what's the matter? And he was just depressed. He just didn't want to talk. And I said, Philip, I don't understand. Everybody likes you. You're funny. You're really funny, and you have friends, and everybody really likes you. And he said, well, that helps. But you could tell he was just sad. And I learned later that oftentimes boys of that age might start going through a time of depression. So maybe that was just a changing, perhaps.
Okay. But then there was there an incident that followed that? I don't know what the time frame, but that you had mentioned that he had threatened you all?
Oh, that was a long time beyond that, yes.
Okay.
That was 2019, actually. So he was...
Okay. I was just wondering if you were observing that kind of behavior back when he was in his formative
years. He was very quiet, and he was too quiet, I think, for his own good, and he didn't say what was in his mind enough. So we just thought everything was fine a lot of the times because he was just a quiet kid. Mm-hmm. If he did get mad, it seemed like he would get pretty mad and then cool off and go on his way. So I don't think I noticed anything until the alcohol and drugs started in as far as really violent type behaviors. Nothing I would have considered out of the ordinary for a child.
Okay. And you had a total of five children.
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot. That's a lot of work.
It's
a lot
of
effort that goes into that, right?
Yeah, there.
That's not an easy task. Kelly and I have three adult boys, men now, I guess. But I remember growing up that it's definitely there's not a guide on how to raise your children.
And no.
You do the best you can with the tools that you have. Kelly, do you want to kick off one of your first questions?
Well, I want to just. Go to take what you said just a little bit further because, you know, we have three children, you have five, and all their personalities are very different. So when you say he's a quiet child, there are quiet children. Mm-hmm. And but I do think today in society it is important, and I think we overlook sometimes that so much is bottled up and it's not being expressed, but it's a matter of understanding when it's a quiet child or when somebody needs to express something. Mm-hmm. So that's a whole nother conversation, obviously. But one of the things that was just playing in my mind is maybe if you guys would be open to sharing maybe the last words that were spoken or that you remember conversation-wise before this took place.
I do remember my last words to him, and happily they were, I love you. He had been at our house discussing a problem with his dad, and he's very thin, and I was worried he wasn't eating enough. And I said, hey, you know, do you want some food? Are you hungry? He goes, well, I only eat once a day. And I said, well, I'll send this home with you. I had some dinner there, and I gave it to him, and I gave him a hug, and I said, I love you. And we both tried to make a habit of always saying that when the kids would leave. So, yeah, I can at least say that.
Hmm. Well, the last time I saw him in person, same thing. I told him I loved him, gave him a hug. But I had talked to him on the phone after that when he was using alcohol and drugs, and he was very upset that he wasn't being allowed to see his son because he wasn't in any shape to see his son. And his son's mother wouldn't allow it. And so he was upset about that, and that made more drinking, that made abusing drugs that he was getting legally, but taking too many of them. And so I had further conversations with him on the phone that weren't anything I'd like to remember. But the last physical time that I was with him in a room, I told him I loved him and gave him a hug.
So were either of you with him the day of the event of...
No.
No, we hadn't had, actually we had a restraining order against him, so we really couldn't have any contact with him, and he wasn't supposed to be calling us or anything. And we got the restraining order after he showed up at our house and slashed our tires and broke the back windshield of my wife's car out. This all had to do with us not willing to get on his side and help him convince his son's mother to relent and let him see his son, because we knew he wasn't in any shape to do it. So we had suggested write a letter, try FaceTime, those things first, mm-hmm. and we'll do a gradual step, because he hadn't been in his son's life for a year at that point. And his in and out thing with his son was causing mental problems with his son. And dad would show up, and then dad would disappear. And so he needed more constant exposure to his dad than that. And his dad, you know, had been drinking or taking drugs. We couldn't allow that. So then the anger started coming out.
What were the behavior patterns like, or signs that you, because he was, 37 when this happened? And he's 30. So when did you start noticing behavior patterns or any signs that indicated that, you know,
something
harmful
happened? I think the very
earliest
one was back when he was in high school, and he snuck out of the house, and him and a friend of his went and found somebody to get him some alcohol. And at that time, I had a side job where I was testing people for alcohol for, like, the Department of Transportation and BNSF and places like that. And so I made him take a breathalyzer. Mm-hmm. And he blew a .223, which is significant. so then we started paying a little more attention to it and trying to make sure that we knew where he was and what he was doing and wasn't sneaking out and mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. like that. But that was probably the earliest time where we realized that, hey, you know, maybe he's messing around with alcohol. And that was like 17, 18 years old. So
okay. That's not uncommon. I mean,
Right.
Did it escalate to the point where you felt like there was a triggering event? I guess I'm trying to help our audience have some perspective here, because everybody's going through the same things, you know, in one degree or another, raising kids and helping from your perspective on things that you can share. Do you feel like there might have been a triggering event at some point?
I can answer that to what I think it was, and I think, it came back to his son. He wanted to be with his son. His ex-girlfriend, they were not going to marry. She was not going to marry him because of the alcoholism. And he wanted to be with his son. And for a while, we did monitor visitations, and he was doing well. And then when we saw that he wasn't doing well and he had started drinking, we said, we can't keep doing this. So it all, I think, got worse and worse to the fact that he couldn't see his son. And then, as fate would have it, he had gotten a job at a cigar store in Overland Park, first day on the job, and his ex-girlfriend and her boyfriend, they didn't know that, but they went there to get a cigar for his dad, and he saw them. And so the realization of, some other man is going to have my son, and I can't have him. And I think that's when he really started to go down, and it just got worse and worse. And then he got angry conversations on the phone, like with Paul and myself, because he wanted to have his son, and he was not safe, and it was not going to happen.
So that frustration, anger, the resentment then started to build.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it sounded like the two of you started to kind of become somewhat afraid.
Yes.
Personally.
Yes. He got a gun.
Well, especially when he came over and cut our tires and then texted saying something, you know, like, check your truck or whatever, and the tires were flat and slashed. And then he came back and broke out the windshield, or the back windshield of my wife's car. Same thing. We had to have both cars towed from the driveway, and, you know, went to quite an expense. And, yeah, it felt very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, he could come any time. Sure. And whatever.
Worse and worse and worse.
Right.
Yeah.
Scary situation.
And that's about the time we notified the police. We did a police report on that, but we did notify him that we thought he had a gun. We were told from another family member that Philip had been by, visited him, and that he had not threatened him with a gun, but let him know he had one. And as soon as we found that out, we got a hold of the police, and we said, he's got a gun, FYI, be on the lookout. So
he already had a record, of doing things wrong.
Well, he shouldn't have had a gun, for sure.
No.
And he'd been arrested for felony before. He'd been arrested in Lawrence for assaulting a police officer. And he should not have been out on bail, we didn't think.
That's something that we felt strongly about and would like to see changed, in fact. And we did go talk to Steve Howe about, what do you have to do to change a law? Although, if you read the law in Kansas, it said a person doesn't have to have bail if they're considered a danger to society. And he was most definitely a danger to society. And he had robbed a cigar store 3 times when he assaulted that police officer. And he hadn't gone to court yet on those charges, but they were felony charges that he had against him. And we thought that, since he had assaulted a police officer, and he was clearly under the influence of drugs, people like him shouldn't be allowed to bail out of jail in 5 hours. And, he was constantly being bailed out by this acquaintance, an older woman who was a dance student of his. And he didn't spend more than 5 hours in the jail. I think he was arrested 3 times or something. And we would like to see that changed I, in fact, did write a letter to the judge the 3rd time. I said, he's not safe. This is the things he's done, and he's not safe. And I would have loved to have seen, he has to stay here a while. He has to dry out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And he didn't. Right. And this woman seemed to have endless money because the judge did raise the bail as high as she said she could. And yet he got bailed out again. And so
So this was just a group of friends or a friend that kept bailing
him out? A specific woman. She herself, I think, had some problems, some difficulties. She's since passed away. But she drank a lot, had drugs. She was a much older woman. I think she took him in as a son kind of thing. But
she was bailing him out.
She had problems of her own that she just kept throwing money at him and bailing him out.
And allowing him to drink with her
and do drugs.
And do drugs. And yeah. It wasn't good, but the judge raised the bail to $290,000, and she came up with
actually it got 10%. Up to 440. It actually got up to $440,000.
She came up with 10% and bailed him out, and he's out on bail, and that's when he killed Mike.
Well, let me let's pivot to. Can you share your experience with how did people in the community respond to you both after this incident?
I first want to start with, how did you find out about the incident?
Oh, yeah. It gave me chills when you said that.
We were at home watching television that night.
I was downstairs sewing. You were, yeah.
I had heard saw on my news app that there was a Overland Park police officer that had been killed and a suspect had been killed. And that's all they knew at that point in time. And about a half an hour later, there's a knock on the door.
It was a police knock.
It was my brother, Dan, who's a retired Overland Park police officer, and he is now the chief of police for Blue Valley Schools. And several Leawood officers came knock on the door to notify us that Philip had died in a gun battle with Overland Park police.
I'm really sorry.
I was sewing when he was upstairs with the television, and I heard kind of about this. When I heard that it was a hit and run, Philip had a hit and run before, and he got away, and he got out of it. And so I thought, I wonder if it was Philip. And when I came upstairs, and we had said prayers that evening, we were saying our rosary, actually, and we had just finished when the big knock came at the door. And when the big they seemed huge at the time, like the big presence of police officers in the room. And I looked at the one, I said, is it Philip? And he said, yes. And then I realized, oh my gosh, it wasn't just Philip. He killed a police officer. And then came, was he married? Did he have children? And then all the yes and yes, and then it was just, oh my gosh, no, this couldn't be any worse. We knew he would die of his addiction. We knew that he was going to die. We figured he'd drive his car into a tree or something. At least that would be hopeful over other things.
Hopefully it wouldn't kill anybody else.
But there was nothing we could do to stop what was going on there. And when we found out that he took Mike, it was crushing. It was crushing. It was just the most horrible feeling in the world to know that he had taken Mike with him, and then he had a family, and it was just, it was
devastating.
Yeah.
Well, I came from the fire department myself, Overland Park Fire, and my brother Dan was with Overland Park Police. My brother Tom was with Shawnee Police. My brother Pat was chief of police at Veterans Administration. And so I'm in a law enforcement fire background and work closely with some of the Overland Park police officers specifically. I knew them by name and had, you know, gone to parties and things. Mm-hmm. And I was, I felt like crawling in a hole.
Yeah, can't imagine.
I didn't want to face them. Yeah. I'm going to look at me thinking, this son of yours killed this police officer. What, you know, what kind of person are you? Mm-hmm. You raised this person. And it was just like a knife in the heart. You know, it's hard to describe.
Never saw that coming.
Yeah. I'm so sorry for your loss as well, and I can't imagine, you know, that getting that news. That's got to be so devastating.
Well, I just wanted to say you get the news, and you both are experiencing it in your own way, and you can't prepare for grief in any regard, and so your brain's trying to wrap itself around what they're telling you because you can't even imagine this unthinkable just happened. But then you guys reach out. I just have to ask, just like I did, was that divinely inspired? Like the idea that we are going to send food to this home, where did that come from, and how did you guys get
there?
Well,
we have to correct that a little bit because we didn't actually do that. Who did that was our grandson's stepfather. His name was Zach, and he knew Mike. He knew Mike. They had been friends and been in high school. And he contacted you, I believe, and he sent food. And then when Shelley knew that he knew us, then she told Zach, I want you to get in touch with them, and I want you to tell them. I want you to tell his mother. He said specifically, we want them at Mike's funeral. We want them to come. And I'm like, you got to be kidding.
This was a day or two after, I believe.
I think so. Time all blurs.
Our other son came back in town and was there at the time. I was outside talking to him in the driveway, and Julie came out the door and said, you're not going to believe this. The Mosiers want us to come to their son's funeral. And I felt like I was levitating off the driveway. It was incredible. It's like somebody threw me a life preserver, said, here, we're going to pull you out. And I said, I don't care if they want to whip me. I'm going. You know, it was.
I said, I'd do whatever she asked. I don't know why she wants us there, but I'll do whatever she wants.
And how did that gesture allow you both to move forward then?
Just like I said, I felt like I had weight completely lifted off my shoulders. And it was like, if the Mosiers don't have a problem with us, then I think that the rest of Overland Park Police won't have a problem with us, and the fire department and those people, even friends of Mike, and that realized that we tried to do what we could do to help Philip in our own way, and tried to do it the right way through AA, through taking him to the doctor and helping him financially do those things, and that they're not blaming us. I felt like it was a lift of you're being blamed for this, and it was all in my head. I mean, nobody blamed us. No, we didn't get a cross word from anybody. Much the opposite, especially after the Mosiers' generous invitation. Anywhere I went, I know when I went, walked into the pro shop at my club, the people in the pro shop that knew me were crying when I walked in. And it had complete opposite effect of what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be, you know, I got to make excuses for, you know, everything we tried to help them and all that. And it wasn't any of that. There wasn't any judgment from anybody.
But you said, because we all do, we get these things in our heads.
Yeah.
And then we believe those to be true, and they're not true. But right. Then those beliefs, they change our decisions. And so it could have been just as easily for you to say, no, there's no way I'm going there based on what my perception of people are going to think of us.
Right.
It took a lot of courage for you to step into that space, I would guess.
That was his mother asking, and it's like, I will do whatever
we
she
went,
wants.
We went to the funeral, and we sat in the front row. And
she held my hand the whole time.
Exactly. We rode in the family car to the cemetery. We were there in the tent being saluted by hundreds of police officers and firefighters that were there. It was surreal, actually just surreal. I felt like I was somewhere else.
And they came to Phillips.
And then we invited them to come to Phillips' funeral, and they came to Phillips.
It was during COVID, so things were a little weird about, you know, how people could contact you or be with you, but our priest was good about bring everybody you want to bring. And so they came with us. And, you know, I still have the handkerchief in my coat pocket that Shelley's mom gave me. It's embroidered little hanky that she gave me. So I was crying, and I keep it all the time.
Yeah, that had to feel like a life raft. You jumped overboard, and you're floating away from the ship in panic, and then here comes a life raft. Right.
Because you said the word blame, and I'm curious, in the very beginning, did you blame yourselves? Even though you knew.
I don't think there's any way not to at least question that. I did. I mean, it was like, mm-hmm. if we'd have just recognized this, or we just tried that, or we, and it wasn't any one thing that would have changed what was going on with him. It was a culmination of a whole bunch of things.
But I think it's good for the audience to hear that, because we can get ourselves in this endless loop.
Right.
And it's a losing game.
Exactly. Then I'd go into depression, and then Julie go into depression, and then we're not helping anybody. We got grandkids and other children that depend on us.
Well, and what I'd like to say, too, is one word that encompasses all of it is mercy. They've shown us nothing but complete and total mercy. Shelley was calling me. Let's go to lunch. Let's talk. I'm having a bad day. How are you? And it wasn't just a one-time thing. It was a continuous friendship.
We've become friends.
And went out to dinner together. And
still, we're planning to go out to dinner now at some point.
And so it's mercy, and it's total mercy and total forgiveness. And when you're given, I said in one of these things that I gave, that it's like you. At first, it's like you can't look that mercy in the face. You just don't feel like you deserve it. And then they made it to where, oh, yeah, you do. Oh, yes. Yes. And then you want to pass that forward. And you got to keep it right here in the front of your mind. Who needs mercy today? Who am I mad at? Who am I going to forgive? You know, if they can forgive us this, who can we not forgive? You know, we really have to work at that sometimes, you know, like, we have to, and they brought that to us. You know, when you're given that mercy and you're given that forgiveness, your job is to pass it forward. That's why we do these things. That's why we will talk. We're hoping that other people will hear that and think, man, if that can happen, you know, maybe we can forgive so-and-so for whatever's going on there, and to forgive ourselves, you know, because we're faithful people, but it's like the minute something like that happens, the devil's right there saying, if you only hadn't done this, and you did that, and you were imperfect, and you made mistakes, and if you don't forgive yourself, not that you ever did anything intentional, if you don't forgive yourself, it's hard to go on.
Yeah, I know for, you know, Kelly and I, in our life, the story of the ravine, when that incident happened, that was where I immediately went to is how did I miss this? Why didn't I notice something here? I should have, you know, reached out and been a better friend. And so that was a weight. And the way that I dealt with that is then I started looking for clues and signs and digging everything up and interviewing people and trying to figure, But I never, you know, the reality of it was I was never going to find an answer. But I think to your point, though, it's a great representation, and the ultimate example is Jesus on the cross when he says, "Forgive them, Father, they know not what they do."
Exactly.
And that is what happened here, and I think it's what happened in our experience. But, I mean, Scott, what you know, what you and your wife did, and it's a beautiful story. I mean, I've never heard a story like this, and that's why I was so, you know,
there are not many people like them.
Well, another twist yes. of the story is that we've been longtime members in the Catholic Church at Our Lady of Good Counsel, which is the Shrine of Divine Mercy in Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri.
So mercy is
and the Mosher family has taught us what it really means. You know, the working mercy.
And I always like to throw this in that I got a puppy after this situation. Her name's Mercy. Oh. Then we got another one later. But I said, when I get a dog, her name's going to be Mercy. Every time I call her, Mercy. One. Sometimes she's not merciful.
If you get another one, you can name him Scott.
Well, I do have another one, but he was actually named Lefty for other reasons.
I've been called a dog before.
We were talking about, or maybe someone asked me, what was the most unlikely friendship? And this has got to be one of the greatest examples that I have ever seen. And I think one of the words that comes to me is, well, multiple, is you do have to let go, you know, of those ideas or those beliefs that aren't serving you to open up to the new of what can come into your life. And you know, obviously the podcast is about bringing awareness to forgiveness, possibly allowing someone to think differently in their own lives of maybe what they could look through with a new lens. But I would like to know from each of you, you know, I believe, especially Scott was saying early on, that he did not really offer forgiveness in his younger years, especially to himself. But now you are, and you're offering it to so many others. What has that opened up? What does that feel like for you? How has that changed your life?
Well, it was growing up, I had no forgiveness. But then after I met my wife, Shelley, I started learning about forgiveness. And I don't know why it was instant forgiveness the night that this happened. I had no malice in my heart because I had lived a life of not being forgiving. And I didn't want to feel that way. And when I thought, I have no malice towards Philip and what happened. I had no malice towards his family, towards his parents. Philip made his own choices. And they were choices, you know, guided by, you know, being, you know, on drugs and alcohol. And it wasn't really who he was, but it was, you know, we make choices and little things build into bigger things and it changes. You know, I've had that with my sons, my own family. And I will tell you, it never entered into my mind or my wife's mind to blame the Carneys for what had happened. And, you know, Philip made his choices there and Mike made his choices. But what always comes back to me and what Shelley would tell me and we would discuss is that they lost a son too. And that son was a valued member of their family and was loved. And, you know, when children make a decision that causes you pain, it doesn't mean that you don't love them anymore. Mm-hmm. It just means that you're now pained by their choices, their free agency. And It malice never entered me because I want to be able to live my life without regret. I want to live my life moving forward as the Lord would have me live it. And the Carneys are a part of that. I look at them as solid, good friends and more than friends because we've shared a tragedy together that nobody else has shared. And a relationship that is one of love and respect. Hmm. And, you know, I can imagine if my child had done what Philip did, how I would feel. And I don't want them to feel that way because it has nothing to do with them. You know, my kids make bad decisions all the time growing up. I got to tell you, I think Mike was a perfect child. He hid everything well. But, you know, and my other kids, and I love them. And, you know, we all grow from our decisions of what we do in life. And I wouldn't have thought any different. I felt the hurt that they felt for losing their son like I did for mine.
One thing you said to me at the time, I'll never forget, you were saying that you had this vision of Mike putting his arm around Philip and saying, come on, let's go.
Yeah.
Grow up together.
We're going to heaven.
Well, and I always like to point out that the very first words that Shelley told me when I actually saw her before the funeral, she walked up to me and said, Jesus loved your son as much as he loved mine, and we both lost a child that day. And I go, oh my gosh, how could she, you know, she's just so merciful. And
that's really powerful.
It was powerful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they walked us to the front row to sit down with the family, the front row with the, in the auditorium where there was 400 and some odd police officers.
Yeah. And we were proud to have them there.
You will never meet people like them. I mean, in a lifetime, you're a rarity. And you really do know the meaning of forgiveness. And
everybody agreed with that.
He's you know, what is that saying of unforgiveness is a poison. It hurts the one who drinks it. And I think that's so very true. You know, it just eats a person alive if you can't forgive.
Right. Well, and I think about, you know, we can't control the events, but we control what we're going to do, how we're going to think, and how we're going to use that one way or the other. And I think you guys are a great example of turning something very painful into something with purpose.
One thing I've been able to do since then is go back. You know, I've been on the earth now 68 years, and in that time I've had rubs with people along the way, teachers from grade school even, you know, things that happen in your life where you don't like that person anymore. Well, I've gone back and I've rethought about some of those, and I've forgiven those people for whatever they did. I was, you know, gone to school with the nuns at St. Anne's grade school, and back then they were pretty tough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an early age, one of them, I kept forgetting to do something I was supposed to do, and I got put in a mop closet, and they called my mother, and she came down, and my mother didn't like that very much and told the nun that wasn't going to happen anymore. But I carried something about that nun after that for a long time. I thought that just wasn't right. Well, I've gone back and forgiven her. Mm. And there's other, you know, when a teacher's in high school, whatever, embarrassing moments where people put you on the spot or did something wrong to you in some way, and you walk around carrying that torch for, you know, and it's time to let that go. It's time to put the torch out and let that go.
Let it go.
Very freeing experience.
Very powerful phrase, just let it go.
Let it go.
And mine's kind of the opposite that I've actually learned is I still seek out my first stepmother. After my mom died, we moved to Okinawa. My dad married a lady named Nobuko Nakasone. Of course, that's all I have is her name. And I treated that person with total contempt and aggravation for the 5 years my dad was married to her. And she was such the she really was probably one of the nicest ladies you'd ever meet. But I could never treat her right. If I could go back, and I've looked for her. Of course, we moved to the United States and been here many years. And when I finally understood, you know, the kind of kid that I was growing up and how I treated everybody because, you know, I had blame in my life instead of forgiveness, I would love to find her and just apologize and give her a hug and let her know how much I love and care for her now for everything she did for me that I could never see. Mm-hmm. If I could find her, I would apologize. And I think one day I'll be able to do that, you know, in another life. But Yeah, that's the one, if you talk about regret, that's probably the biggest regret I have in my life is how I treated her.
And, I think you made up for it, though, maybe.
Yes, I think so.
I
think,
hope so.
I think you've earned some stripes out there.
For your whole life. I mean, if you can apologize for things that you did and forgive people for what they did to you, you're going to lighten your load, for sure.
Yeah.
Very much for sure.
I don't want to live my life bitter.
Yeah.
I want to live my life that I can be an example. You know, when you tell people and you speak from the heart, people look at that as being, I guess, fluff, rather than use the word bull. But people look at that as fluff because that's not who they are. And when you speak from the heart in a lot of cases because, you know, and you try to say this is exactly how I feel, people don't take that into consideration because that's not how they feel. You know, if you talk about forgiveness and people say, yeah, I forgive, but it's not really the way it is.
Yeah.
It's superficial because
it's words.
They don't change the behavior.
Right.
So,
but you know. You may just be planting a seed. They may reject it initially because they can't fathom themselves being able to do that. But the story and starting to look through a different lens, I believe you're planting a seed. And I guess one of the questions that I wanted to ask you guys is and I have learned through my own experience, you cannot prepare for the unthinkable, but it will prepare you if you're open to it, to what you're supposed to become from it or what you can become from it. And I guess I'm talking about moving pain to purpose. And if we're promised that there's good in everything, I guess what is your purpose in this now? Like, what is your hope? Is it to continually to talk and bring awareness around what? I guess
mercy.
That's what I meant.
Mercy and forgiveness.
Okay. Mercy and forgiveness. Yeah. And my wife is actively involved, and I've been a little bit, to try to get the laws changed to get these people that are having problems with alcohol and drugs, once they are arrested, to be properly evaluated before they just turn them loose, set them back on the street again because somebody made their bail for them. Mm-hmm. They need to be properly evaluated. In order for that to happen, they need to be completely off of drugs and alcohol, whatever that takes, so that then they can be evaluated to see what the baseline is and what needs to happen from here on. And so those laws need to change. In my opinion, if anybody is going to attack a police officer to cause bodily harm, they should not be given bail, period, the end, at all. They've proven that they are willing to take on a police officer, heavily armed police officer, and try to do physical harm to him. Then they've taken themselves out of the game, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, in Douglas County, they have the SIMS program that Paul and I got to go listen about that with the Johnson County Criminal Justice Advisory Board? I think that was their title. Judges were there and a lot of people, and they have a program in Douglas County now that will be hopefully soon completed in Johnson County about, you know, if you have a person's got mental health issues, it usually hand in hand with drug abuse, trying to medicate themselves, let's evaluate them. Let's see if they need to be arrested and put into jail, or do they need to go through these steps of being rehabilitated, which is like five different steps, even to the point of getting housing for those who have made it all the way to the top if they didn't have, you know, a house or whatever. But it starts off with a better evaluation of that person. And, hey, look at their record. I mean, Philip had a pretty long record of violence in Johnson County and Douglas County, and I'm not sure that they were seeing both sides at the time. But if you know that, if that's on the record, it's right there, and you have a person you know has mental health or drug addiction things, Let's slow that process down. Let's see if we can get them some help.
Right.
Instead of you're in jail, somebody can bail you out, they've got the money. That just was so wrong. And I even talked to the bondsman one day. We went to the court to get the restraining order, and Philip did show up there. We were hoping he wouldn't, but he did. And we were a little concerned about leaving there since he was there. And so I asked the lady at the desk, I said, you know, we're not too wild about us leaving and having him leave behind us. And she says, well, we'll hold him here for a while. Okay, so he leaves in his car, I leave in mine. And his truck was very noticeable. And Philip got out there and tried to run his dad off the road with the car that he probably borrowed from somebody because it wasn't his. And so I called the bondsman and said, if he ever contacts you, if he ever does this, if he ever does that, we'll put him right back in jail. So I called him. I said, well, he tried to run us off the road. And we got the license number, and we know it was him. And he goes, oh, you could have gotten that in the parking lot. I'm like, no. He tried to run his dad off the road. We know it was him, and he needs to be back in jail. And he goes, well, no, we don't really have the evidence for that because you could have just gotten his license plate in the parking lot. You know, nobody else is coming forward with it.
His word against our
So word. I wonder how he feels now. It's like he should have been. And actually, they were looking for Philip to put him back in jail because he had another felony against him the Friday before he died, and he was supposed to go back to jail, and there was supposed to be no bond. And in my mind is, why could that have not already happened, that there was no bond, you know? So there's that.
So there is trying to get the law changed. There is doing podcasts like this, or we've also gone and done some work with retreats. We went and did a, you know, a guest.
Forgiveness retreat.
Give our, what we're doing here at a retreat for 30 or 40 people, and then took questions afterwards, and whatever avenues open up for us, we're willing to do that, to get this message out, message mm-hmm. of forgiveness and message of mercy.
And a message of hope?
And a message of hope.
What is the message of hope you'd like to share with the audience?
One thing I would like to say is that we've had immense counseling that has been so helpful to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, our counselors happened to be kind of connected to us through a family member, and they came to the funeral, and they said, please let us help you. And it took a while, but then I went, later Paul went. He was having a harder time with it.
I can handle this.
But then when you went, wasn't it like, oh, gosh, this is so helpful?
Yes.
And they've been so good for us, and in fact, they have taken us a couple places to talk about, you know, forgiveness. But people hesitate to get counseling. Like, you know, I'll be fine, I don't need this, I'm whatever. Don't do that. Go get the counseling. Go let them help you when it comes to grief especially and forgiving yourself and moving forward. The counseling is everything, really. I mean, it's been so helpful to both of us. And it helped us, you know, I think in all these situations, you know, it's like you're remembering his mistakes, he's remembering my mistakes, you know, and it comes down to like, forgive each other. Nobody here meant to do anything wrong.
Sure.
Nobody. Mm-hmm. And that forgiveness has to be here as well. And that also helps you to move forward. And so there is good that comes out of this terrible tragedy. And what else can you do with the tragedy? You know, it just gets worse and worse and worse.
Well, you help somebody else avoid it.
Yeah.
And you help somebody else try and avoid the pitfalls that you fell into. And the hope would be that people hear this podcast and they maybe get involved early on with a family member, a son or daughter, whoever's with the alcoholism or the drug abuse or whatever, and don't enable. I mean, don't be naive about it. Mm-hmm. Realize that with drug and alcohol abuse also comes deception and lying, and to get what your body needs at that point. They're willing to do or say anything to get what they want. And it takes a little while to figure out that you're being duped. When you're on the giving end of that, or you're on the enabling end of that, and don't be duped. Mm. Don't be duped. Don't fall into it. Don't hand them money. Don't realize you're just handing them drugs or you're handing them alcohol when you do that. And you know, you have to take a tough love stance. And the earlier on, I think the better. Not that you don't love them.
But we couldn't let him live with us.
You're not going to enable him.
Yeah, he couldn't live with us. He was dangerous. So. I think there were people who judged us for that, too, not letting him come back and live with us. It's like, no, he won't be safe.
So have you let go? Was that easy? Was that hard for you to be able to let that go, other people's opinions and ideas?
The counseling helped with that quite a bit. And then the counseling helps you to realize you did what you had to do. You know, like I can look back and say, no, I know that it was the right thing to not have him live with us. He was dangerous. He threw his dad to the ground twice, said he's going to kill him.
Well, it was also the right thing to do, to not let him see his son. In the shape
Hard
he
as
was
that
in,
was.
In the shape he was in, it wouldn't have been good for his son at all. So our decision just not to be complicit in allowing him or getting on his side to help him see his son unless he was in the proper, you know, condition to do that and insist on that. And it did cause him to become angry, and, you know, I'm sorry, but
we have no regrets about
there's
that.
There's a greater good here. Yeah.
No, his son is his child. He needs to be protected. His sure. life needs yeah. to be good. So we have no regrets for protecting him.
Well, you did the best you could at the time, and you can't look back because everything happens for a reason.
Right.
Yeah, so. Well, I want to thank you, I know, on behalf of Kelly and I.
I want to thank all
Paul
of you.
Paul, Julie, and Scott for coming together and sharing your story, because I know your story is going to impact a lot of people, and it's going to continue to do that. Sorry it did that again for me, and I'm sure for Kelly today, because I really appreciate you guys and your heart. And I think your story is going to end up on national news at some point. It should, because it's that powerful. And everybody needs this message. So thank you for sharing it.
Well, you'd like to think if hurt people can hurt people, maybe merciful people can create merciful people. And you started that. So we'd like to let that go forward.
My hope is that people will understand forgiveness and know that it's calming to the spirit, that it allows you to move forward. There's no bitterness in what happened. There's total forgiveness and there's no bitterness. It created a friendship that we would have never been drawn together. And
Jesus
it's one that's appreciated and loved. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that people would understand that, you know, you start with forgiveness for yourself and then you forgive others. And it lifts the burden off your soul mm-hmm. as, you know, like I said, if I could find my first stepmother, and I had several, but if I could find the first one and just apologize and tell her that, ask for her forgiveness, how complete I would be. And I will one day. But my point being that my hope is that other people will find it, because you see all over where people are bitter and they live their life to make other people's lives miserable through their bitterness, through their being unforgiving of themselves and for the circumstances that got them to where they are not being forgiving. And it just changes your life. It makes you, I don't want to be a bitter old man. I want to be loving. I have a wife that I love dearly. After Shelley, who I love dearly. And I want to be able to be a good husband. I want to be able to be a good grandfather. I want to be able to talk about my son through good memories. That's who I want to be. And I would hope that others who are not forgiving might get a message that say, hey, it's a simple step, you know.
Well, this John, Julie, and I are much closer together mm-hmm. than we've ever been.
That's true.
Been married 47 years.
And how odd is that, that you would have this do that?
I think we're more in love now than we ever have been.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's her statement. Yeah. So it's like, how does that happen? You know, through mercy.
So that's part of Philip's legacy.
Yeah, you could say that.
Wow, that. I actually want you to say that again. That is so powerful what you just said.
I said I believe that Julie and I are more in love now than we have ever been, and we've been married for 47 years.
That's a true statement.
And I think that's part of Philip's legacy as well.
Yeah. I don't know how we can outdo that, so that's really, you know, we are told that everything will be used for good, and it takes a lot of faith early on because you don't see the seeds of how could any good come out of a tragedy like mm-hmm. this? But that is very
powerful. Who would have predicted that? Who would have predicted
what
that?
You just shared?
Thanks. I said something to Father Mattingly at the funeral for our son. I was standing in the back of church, and I said, the Mosher family is coming. They're going to sit them in the front row with us. And And he looked at me and he says, the Mosher family's coming. I said, yes, the Mosher family's coming. And I said, it looks like God took the wreckage and made a masterpiece out of it.
Yeah. Wow. So true.
And we wouldn't have done it any other way.
He does my crying for me.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
I'd like to say, too, that where I worked and where Paul worked, the people I work with are like another family, and they were wonderful, and they were so helpful, and they made everything so much easier, and they gave so much love. When I went back to work, they were just sisters all over around you, you know, and everybody, it was wonderful. I mean, I didn't want to walk around and show my face either at the time. I just wanted to hide back in my little corner, but it made a difference too. Those people around us, God put those people there. Around us that helped us. That was no accident. I can't imagine having gone back to work with anything else. But I did ask them one time, I said, who of you could forgive the parents of a drug addict who killed your son? And they're all like, I don't think so. And then when I said that to Shelley and, you know, and Scott, they said, we couldn't see it any other way.
That's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's amazing.
Well, I know that this conversation is going to cause so many people to think. Good. It's really an important idea to think and maybe, you know, look through a different lens and start possibly seeing things from the eyes of the understanding of forgiveness.
Dr. Wayne Dyer had a saying. He said, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change, and you definitely are causing people, I think, to do that in their own lives. So, again, thank you guys so much, and I guess we'll wrap it up right now.
Thank you for having us. I'm glad to do this.
All right. Well, we'll see you again on another inspiring episode of Time for Forgiveness. Thank you for being here, and I would ask you to subscribe to the show by clicking the box here. That allows us to grow the program, bring you more inspiring stories that can impact you in a positive way. And once again, thank you for your support of Time for Forgiveness.